Before I get started today, I wanted to give a big shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie Colwin is a stress and TMS coach based in Los Angeles. If you're not familiar with Jeannie, let me introduce her. She used to be a burnt out high school teacher who struggled for nearly two decades with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, anxiety, depression, digestion issues, etc. before healing herself completely and leaving that dead-end job. Simply put, she gets it, especially the frustration of doing all the things and still not seeing the results that you deserve. If this is you, I encourage you to book a free introductory call to learn more about her one-on-one coaching program. During that call, she's going to identify the specific blocks that are getting in the way of you fully healing. Trust me, uncovering these obstacles is definitely going to be worth your time. Go to jeanniecolwin.com, that's JeannieKulwin.com, to book your free call. And while you're on the website, check out that impressive testimonials page to see her clients' transformations firsthand. Welcome back to the show. My name is Eddie Lindenstein. As you're listening to this, you may be, if you're a patron, preparing for our Patreon get-together, which is happening today as you listen to this, February the 22nd at 12 p.m. Pacific. If you're not a patron of the show, I encourage you, maybe go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. Throw a few bucks in the tip jar every month, and you will be able to attend these things. Let me give a shout out to some of the patrons of the show. So these are people that are eligible to go. There's about 25 of them. Some have been here for as little as a couple of weeks and other for as many as 5 or 6 years at this point, which is crazy. So let me give a shout out to, and a thank you to Leslie, Carrie, Mary, Teresa, Albert, Jeff, Julie, Deborah, Daniel, Kirk, Elise, Dominic, John, Jason, Mindy, Irina, Kelly, Tony, Michael, Christina, Julie, Brian, Sarah, Arnie, and Barb. Thank you all so much for continuing to support the podcast every single week and month and year, in the case for some of you, really, really means a lot. This week's podcast is going to be a replay, episode 140, Dr. Douglas Gufrida, who came to me from the University of Rochester on September 9th of 2020. So this is a show that's about 3.5 years old at this point. And Doug's been on the show a couple of times. And I've also done some guest teaching to his graduate school courses at the University of Rochester, which is amazing that I'd first heard of him because somebody sent me an excerpt from, I think it was from Counseling Today, a publication where he had mentioned me. And so I reached out to him and we have become long distance buddies, and it's pretty cool. So this is a story of him as somebody who recovered fully from TMS and then somebody who is a practitioner, but then also somebody that is teaching psychotherapy and pain science to his students. So I'm excited for you to re-listen to this because I'm sure there's quite a few of you that have never heard it before. So without further ado, here is Dr. Douglas Gufrida and myself from September 9th, 2020. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast, and I am on the line with somebody that is going to give us an enormous amount of expertise today, a different perspective, which I always love those. We've got a recovery story, a research story, and an ongoing treatment story all jammed into one hour or less. But I have Dr. Douglas Gufrida with me on the line from Rochester, New York. Is that right?
Yep.
Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the show. I recommend it to a lot of my clients, and so it's great to be talking to you.
That is awesome. I appreciate that. And I've read up on you. I know a little bit of your backstory. I know some of the stuff that you're doing at the university, and I'm excited to kind of dive in today. So, you know, oftentimes, like I feel like sometimes people get into the treatment of chronic pain because they suffered from it and were able to come out the other side. So maybe let's start there with, like, you know, you had pain at one point in time. What was it? What were some of the symptoms? What were some of the things you were told? And then ultimately, how did you get out of it? And we'll try and make this an abbreviated version and get into the really juicy stuff after that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I got into this because of my own experience. In hindsight, I've had TMS my whole life. Of course, I never knew it to be that. It was chasing diagnoses, medical diagnoses since I was a kid. There was always something wrong, a bunch of surgeries, sick a lot, you know, all kinds of chronic pain. I wouldn't describe myself as sickly, but I always had something going on. Yeah. And it really came to a head, I think it was like 2005. I had excruciating back pain that was debilitating, and it just kept getting worse. I was chasing around treatments. I did everything everybody else does, from chiropractor. That didn't work, so I got recommended another chiropractor. That didn't work. I tried yoga. I tried 3 cortisone shots. I did acupuncture for a while. I mean, you name it, everything that everybody's done, and it never seemed to get me any relief. And so I was going to do back surgery. I got diagnosed as having a herniated disc and was going to go ahead and have the surgery because I couldn't take the pain anymore. And I found Sarno's book. And I talked to the surgeon and said, is this crazy? You know, is it possible? Because it sounds like me. And he said, you know, look, I don't believe there's anything to this. But at the same time, you know, are a lot of my clients having stress and having the kind of problems in other areas you're talking about? He said, absolutely. It won't hurt you to try this. So I read the book, found myself a therapist. She was not a TMS person. She was a psychodynamic therapist. And I just sat down with her and said, she said, what's your problem? I said, back pain. She said, well, I can't help with that. And I said, I think you can. Here's what I want you to do with me. And we want to dive into this stuff that I'm, you know, having trouble with. And she did. And, you know, after a few months, the back pain was gone. And it's gone forever. You know, I had given up everything physical activity wise. And now I can do everything unrestricted. I don't have any back pain at all without surgery. My torn rotator cuff went away. My arthritic knees are now better. I have no pain from that. I used to have acid reflux. I actually had it operated on.
Oh, wow.
And it was still having problems taking the medicine. And that's gone away. I don't have acid reflux anymore. I used to get migraine headaches. I haven't had one of those in a long time. Stomach problems, GERD. You know, I was diagnosed as having all kinds of digestive problems and being lactose intolerant. That's gone. I'm not lactose intolerant anymore. I can eat dairy unrestricted. So you name it. There's more than that. I could go on and on. I had just a series of problems that all cleared up. So,
you know, it's crazy. I never talk about it on the podcast, but right around the time that you would have been alleviated of all this stuff in 07, I developed acid reflux for the first time. And it felt like somebody had dropped battery acid down my throat. And every time that I would drink anything, particularly with carbonation or anything like that. And I had just turned 21. And so it was like, they'd said no alcohol. They had said a ton of stuff that I were, you know, do nots. And I got rid of that. And then it was just like severe nosebleed after severe nosebleed. So it, you know, it stuff comes up in the most odd form ways. What, I'm kind of curious to get your, you know, one question that I get asked a lot and I get emailed a lot is they say, you know, I don't have an accessible mind-body therapist, or there's not somebody that's close to me, or I've been working with somebody for a while, but they're not specialized in, you know, mind-body or Sarno approach or anything, and they sort of feel like that's the end of the road. And I tell them my story, which is very similar to your story, where it's this person didn't specialize in it, but the stuff that they were enlightening me on helped tremendously. Can you just go into whatever that therapist had specialized in, and how did it correlate, and why did it help you? When because there's so many people I hear from that say, I have a therapist that's not mind body with quotation marks, so I don't think they can help me.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And I tell people that who I'm, you know, maybe call from out of state in places I can't work with people, and they ask what they can do. And I say, get the book. I also recommend Schubner's book to everybody, Unlearn Your Pain, because it's very applied, very practical. It's got work activities in it. But yeah, people can go see anybody who does intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy, ISTDP. The Sarno people have probably heard that term thrown around. That's what I learned to do when I got immersed into this as a practitioner. But, you know, I happen to do the mind-body stuff, but anybody who does ISTDP can be really transformative to someone in chronic pain. You can do the exercise. I also recommend Curable. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yep.
A lot of my folks use that in addition to the ISTDP therapy that we do. So they're constantly doing stuff on their own, journaling, meditation, other sorts of mind-body activities. At the same time, they find a good ISTDP therapist. It's a very small kind of esoteric approach, but it's growing. You know, I just went to the conference last year, and there were several hundred of us there, all focused on this one approach that really helps unlock all these trapped emotions. And in a way that no other approach can touch, I don't think. So I've been a therapist for 20 years, and once I discovered this, everything changed. I mean, the results I get with people, what I can do. People who come to me who say, well, I've been in therapy for 20 years, and I'm, you know, I like my therapist, and I've grown a lot from it, but could I see you also? And I say, sure, we can, you know, work on this together and in conjunction. And once they start seeing what this approach can do, they go, oh my God, what have I been doing all these years? Because this is so different and so powerful.
There's, have you heard of the documentary about Schubiner? Well, it's not about Schubiner per se, but he's like the main, he's the main treater.
Oh, this might hurt?
This might hurt, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet. I just saw the trailer.
So there's
the way it looks, though.
Yeah, so it's largely about, I mean, that's the kind of thing. He's doing that therapy in his office, and even though, you know, he's a physician, he's a medical doctor, so he's not a therapist, but that's what he says is you know, the type of therapy that would be needed for something like this if somebody were to engage in it. So can you, there's a lot of people that have not seen it, but I'm going to recommend it. The filmmakers, I interviewed them for the podcast. I've interviewed Schubiner for the podcast. This might hurt if anybody didn't catch the name, but tell us what is this type of therapy? What does it encompass?
Yeah. I definitely don't consider myself an expert in it. I've only been doing it for about 4 years now. And, you know, I'm immersed pretty deeply into it, but there's lots I have to learn. But I'll give you a brief overview of my understanding. And I would say, first of all, I've had a chance to watch Howard work in his office. He allowed me to shadow him a few days doing this. And he's an amazing therapist who has, you know, never really been trained in therapy. It's quite amazing to watch him work with people. He's gifted in that area. If he was studying full-time as a therapist, he'd probably be unbelievably helpful. But, you know, combined with his medical background, he just can really transform people.
So
intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy, briefly, it's a somatic approach. We focus a lot on the body. It's an attachment-based approach. The idea is to look at, you know, current problems and how they might be impacted by the attachments we form when we're younger. So we develop some strategies or defenses to protect us from experiencing really painful emotions, especially emotions we might have towards other people who are really important to us. We learn early on what's allowed and what isn't to feel and express in our households. And this is shaped largely by primary caregivers. And so if a, you know, we're born as human beings, we're the most helpless creatures when we're born. Our total existence revolves around a connection with caregivers. And so even babies pre-verbal learn what's acceptable and what isn't to their caregivers. And so we have to learn to disassociate from things and expressing things that make them uncomfortable or not able to attend to us the way we need. And so these defenses, strategies we learn to disconnect from emotions are very adaptive when we're younger. They in some ways allow us to be connected to people. But then they become problematic as we get older. And that's what ISTDP, essentially my understanding of it is that we help people reconnect to experiences, often painful ones, and usually complex emotions we have towards people. Sometimes powerful feelings of anger and rage towards someone we also deeply care for and love. And because that's so unacceptable, we have to disconnect from that and bury it inside us. When these feelings get triggered, it causes anxiety because these feelings aren't okay. And that's why we feel pain. It's the anxiety and then the guilt and shame we feel for having this that all happens under the surface. And so in ISTDP therapy, we help people come to terms with feelings that are underneath, learn to identify them, experience and express them in ways that can often be powerful. They call it an unlocking in its true form when it bursts through the unconscious, just releases in a way that's uninhibited with a therapist that has established, you know, really safe conditions to allow that to happen. And it can be dramatic and transformative when it happens. And if you ever, if anyone wants to see an example of what I think is a really nice depiction of an unlocking in a non-therapeutic setting, the movie Marriage Story, I think that's what it's called.
Yep.
People are getting divorced. It's on Netflix. There's this incredibly powerful scene where they get into this fight and the guy has just been holding it all in. And all of a sudden he just unloads with this rage. And it's exactly what I've seen countless times in therapy. And then it hits him how guilty he feels for having this rage, and he breaks into tears in a way that's, you know, just kind of, you know, letting it all go. And that's what an unlocking looks like to me when I've seen him in a real powerful form in therapy.
There's a couple things I'm thinking of, recent real world examples, and both of them have to do with COVID, unfortunately, because it's just kind of especially where you are, it's kind of the main thing on that. Well, New York's actually doing a lot better than it was a couple of months ago as we record this, which, by the way, even though we're recording this on, what is the date today? Tuesday, July the 28th. This probably won't air until close to Labor Day, so who knows what the world will look like then.
Yeah. Hopefully it's not as big of an issue anymore for a lot of the country. That would be wonderful.
Well, so there's a couple things that have been coming up, one of which was a couple of my best friends, and I talked about this in the podcast a couple weeks ago, were just hounding me about being irresponsible by not going to take a COVID test. I had no symptoms. I wasn't exposed to anybody. And they said, you know, they were saying that it was irresponsible to my community and my family's health. And I was putting everybody in jeopardy by not going and getting a test. And, you know, push aside the stupidity of all that, because so much of it is depends on your viral load at that exact particular moment, meaning I could be negative one hour and then positive the next hour. And that's just kind of how the science works behind that. But eventually it was just kind of like they're just pushing me. And I was sitting outside next to my wife on her back deck a couple weeks ago, and I just unloaded on these guys how you're describing in Marriage Story. And it went on and on and on, and it was, you know, F-bomb after all that. Like, it was the stuff that I, you know, 5 years ago never would have said to my best friends, but it was like, it was kind of wild. And she had said, "Do you feel better?" And I was like, "I do. I feel a lot better, actually."
Yeah.
Because I had been just, to me, it was a lot like for, you know, for several weeks, I'm gritting my teeth and just sort of letting them say all these things. And then eventually I just stopped responding to their text messages and everything and shutting it down. Right. Which is what's probably gone on for a lot of people for so long. And then eventually let it all go. And the other one that I'm thinking of is that, lately I've been getting in these, they're not even arguments with my parents, particularly my mom, about COVID and, you know, are the kids allowed outside the house to do anything? You know, so we have differing opinions on that kind of stuff. And lately, if I start to feel some, you know, some aches in my ankles or my elbows or whatever, I hit the journaling, and it's just, you know, 20 minutes sometimes feels like a really long time. And then 20 minutes, sometimes I feel like in this, you know, and when everything's sort of reached a fever pitch, feels like it takes 30 seconds for me to rage for 20 minutes, you know, 20 minutes on a piece of paper. And in This Might Hurt, there's a really terrific example of Schubiter going through this with somebody. And it actually becomes quite the violent scene, because this person, they couldn't bring themselves to say certain things about, so I feel like it might have been their mom or their dad or somebody that was really close. But by the end of it, this person was describing essentially beating the absolute hell out of this person until they were bloody and bleeding and laying. And I feel like that's a place that a lot of people wouldn't be able to take it. Do you find that when you work with a client that, I mean, does it take a long time for you guys to get to that sort of a, you know what I mean? Like, for people to be able to even say that stuff out loud. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it depends on the client. Yeah, there are some that it can take us an awful long time to get to a place where we unlock the rage towards people they care about. Other people, it comes very quickly if they're, you know, they call it low resistant people, which is funny because my first couple of clients I worked with, they got better right away. They were very, very sick with fibromyalgia. And I didn't even know much about fibromyalgia and started working with them right away. And they got better right away with a couple of unlockings and, you know, went from disability and, you know, being very sick to go, you know, being much, much better. And I thought this was just magic. And, you know, I meet with an ISTDP supervisor, and he kind of brought me back down to earth and said, you just had really low resistant. These folks were very low resistant. You didn't have to be particularly skilled to pull this out of them because they were just ready to pop. You know, all the ingredients were there. And unlockings are tricky too. First of all, they're not necessary for everybody, but as you said, they can be therapeutic, especially when your feelings are complex, like your buddies. These are people you care very much about, but you're also enraged about the perspectives. And there's also a difference between truly feeling, experiencing, expressing emotion, like it sounds like you did with your wife when you were talking about them, versus discharge, right? And you may have heard that term before, but so people will say, well, I know people who are angry all the time. They run around screaming at everybody. They're clearly in touch with their rage and they have the worst back pain or, you know, whatever kind of chronic pain. Well, they're probably not really in touch with their anger. What they're doing is discharging it, right? It's like a tea kettle, this anger. It's bubbling up inside and the tea kettle just blows at anything that it's, you know, could trigger it. But it doesn't, it's not adjusting the flame underneath, right? So people who blow up and run around screaming at people actually are not in touch with their anger or rage at all. They're just discharging uncomfortable emotions in a way that somehow became palatable or acceptable to them growing up. And so there's a big difference. And in ISTDP, we help people differentiate between what's discharge, meaning you just got triggered and you blew up at someone who didn't deserve it, who wasn't really the problem, versus real authentic emotion that is complex, that is difficult, that needs to be brought out more carefully.
Now, in Dr. Schubiner's book, and it's been a couple of years since I had read it, I thought that he had said in there somewhere that there was a way to sort of do this on your own as opposed to working with, because, you know, his thing was find a therapist if you can that can do it. If you couldn't find a therapist that you can do it, maybe it's a confidant or a friend that you feel, you know, the immense amount of trust for. I feel like an application like this would be really difficult to find a friend that 100% you don't think they would judge you or anything like that. I'm sure that friend exists out there in the world. I don't know if, I'm not sure I have access to one that I could, you know, say and unleash the absolute deepest and darkest or whatever, whenever they do occur. So how would you describe somebody going about and doing it? Cause there's likely somebody that's, you know, listening to this in Burkina Faso or something like that, that is like, I don't have access to, this, and I don't have somebody that I feel like I can go to. Schubiner has talked about this being able to be done on your own. Can you describe how maybe something like that would be done?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the journaling and meditation activities can be really helpful. I think mindfulness is also very helpful because it teaches people to be comfortable with uncomfortable feelings. And so people who have engaged in mindfulness practice can be more productive, I think, on their own to get at deep-seated emotions too. I think mindfulness is something chronic pain people need to be careful with, because you don't want to meditate away your feelings. Sometimes it gets misinterpreted of just calming myself down and, you know, picturing something that's more pleasant. True mindfulness work dives into the depth of the discomfort and allows it. And so people who do it can be more effective, I think, on their own. I think some of the journaling activities that Howard has, that Nicole Sachs has, and other things that we've recommended can be really helpful to people. But there's a number of folks that, this is, you know, when I was talking to you before, many of the people that I work with need the help of a therapist to work through some of this. So if you can do it on your own, that's amazing and that's great. But a lot of the people that come to me need help, even just identifying sensations in the body. ISTDP practitioner, you know, people will come in and say, I'm getting really angry as they're getting worked up about something. And one of the things we do is we go to the body. We say, how are you experiencing that in your body? And they'll talk about tenseness. My back's starting to hurt. My shoulders are tightening up. I'm starting to get a headache, whatever the complaints are. And one of the things I teach them is that's not anger. They think they're angry, but the body doesn't lie. What that is anxiety. There's an uncomfortable feeling, maybe anger or rage towards someone that they believe somehow they're not allowed to feel. And so I teach them to pay attention to that. The true experience of anger, when people feel it, they'll know it. It's loose, it's free-flowing, it's warm. It comes up through and wants to come push out. There's no pain when someone's really experiencing anger, and they'll know this. The first time they feel it, I'll say, how are you feeling? They say, you know, that my chest was real tight, now it's loose. My shoulders were hurting, and now they're not hurting anymore. Everything feels loose and flowing. That's anger, and once they learn to identify that, they can really do a lot on their own, because they start to differentiate and realize everything they thought before wasn't necessarily true about what they were feeling.
The area, it's funny you said the chest part of it. I did an episode like a year and a half ago because I'm a big mark for Marvel movies, and the best way that I could describe to people on sort of where for me the experience of anger really occurs is right where Tony Stark has his reactor in his chest. So it's interesting that you bring that up.
And it'll be warm and it wants to push out and up. Yep. And that's how you'll know it. And the first time people get in touch with that, it can be a really powerful experience for them.
I visualize the guy on the side of the, you know, I guess name your prescription drug box or bottle, but it's always like, you know, you have the Seinfeld used to have a great he had a great piece of his bit that would talk about this, but essentially the person who has the flames that are like, you know, you take this pill and you won't have the flames that are coming up from your stomach and into your chest and then out, right? That's usually what I think about is this little the little character from pharmaceuticals, which how ironic that it's there.
Yeah, and sometimes when people start to get in touch with the anger and rage, they'll experience acid reflux even if they never had it before. You know, Sarno talked about the symptom imperative and stuff jumps around. And I've noticed acid reflux is one of the ones that as rage starts to come out, the brain somehow interprets that as pain as a way to distract, kind of a last ditch effort to keep people from feeling these things. And so acid reflux is a common one, even if they never felt it before.
So the symptom imperative would be something I'd love to get your take on, especially in your clinical experience is, you know, somebody comes in, and they work with you for, you know, sort of insert your symptom. I mean, do you get people that come back after 2 weeks or maybe you're working together for 4 weeks or 6 weeks or a year or whatever, and they say, I don't really have that thing anymore, but I have this other thing now. Can you just talk about
all the time, all the time. Yeah. Almost everybody who gets better, seldom do they just get better right away. Usually it takes this roundabout way of whatever the primary complaint is, gets better, but then something else pops up, you know, a migraine person with severe migraines for years, the migraines have gotten better, but she throws her back out. You know, those kinds of things. And I'll get frantic calls like, oh my God, I got to go see a chiropractor now. And it's, you know, so remember because I tell everyone this in the beginning. So remember we talked about, the things would change and shift. Yeah. Well, this is part of the healing process and it's a good thing. We want these symptoms on the run. We want them moving, right? It knows it can't fool you anymore with this other thing it's locked into. So it's coming up with a new way because what happens is people are off and running now with fretting, reducing their activity and then just internet searching. Oh my God, it's got to be this or that. And when you're in that state, guess what you're not doing? Feeling any of your feelings, not connected with any of the problems in your life or any of the things that it's triggering from your past. And that's what it's designed to do. So everybody, well, with the exception of just a couple of people, almost everybody I've worked with who's gotten better has some form of symptom imperative that can go from some minor thing that just lasts a couple of days to something that seems major, but just goes away.
So my what it sounds like is that if you have somebody that happens with, it's almost like you're giving a sense of reassurance or confidence to them and, hey, what we're doing is working. We need to stay the course.
Absolutely. I celebrated with them. Yeah. I said, I know it doesn't feel this way right now, but this is great news because, you know, that back pain is now gone. And, yeah, the knee's hurting now, but that's going to go too. It's not going to be as bad and it's not going to, you know, it's not going to stay. It's just another symptom imperative and it'll go too.
Do you ever find like, do you ever get people that almost get, almost like afraid of getting better is not the best way for what I'm trying to describe, but like, you know, somebody comes in with back initially and then it goes to knee and then it goes to ankle. So you have this thing on the move. Did they ever get to a point of like, if I keep doing this, it just means things are going to keep hurting and I don't want things to keep hurting. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, what actually happens most often is the pain is gone, but they start getting confronted and seemingly overwhelmed by emotions. And that's when, so I usually see people every other week, but I'll tell them at a certain point, we might decide to go every week, every other week with a lot of homework in between. And I'll say, and you know, there comes a certain point where it might seem disorienting to you in different ways. And we might want to move the therapy to every other week and we'll figure that out as we go along. And it's usually when the symptoms are gone, there's no more physical pain. But they're overwhelmed with emotional anxiety, depression, all these things are starting to come up and it feels overwhelming. And I will have people tell me more often than not, this is terrible. It was easier being sick or in pain because I didn't have to feel all this stuff.
Yep.
And that's when, you know, good therapists say, we're on the right track here and we're going to do this together and you're going to be okay. And, you know, but that can feel really dangerous to people, unsettling. you know, it's a really difficult time to be in because they're learning a new way of being. They're giving up this other old way of protecting themselves through chronic pain, and they're embracing this emotional state that was so overwhelming when they were younger that they had to come up with these physical symptoms to avoid it. And so that's when I get the, you know, I'm afraid about this because this is hard right now.
Right. So you would mention off air that you have done some research stuff that you've submitted on the topic of chronic pain. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so I'm a qualitative researcher, which means we interview people and talk about their experiences, our watch and study. And I ran two pain groups that I got to permission from the folks to do some interviews. I had a team of grad students go in and interview them at the beginning and in the middle, at the end, about their experiences in the pain group. And then we broke it up to see who got better and who didn't, and what were their experiences as they were going through it. And we found some things that I think were pretty supportive of a lot of Sarno's ideas. So we ended up with, between the two pain groups, the people who finished, who agreed to the interviews, you know, went through the whole thing, were 11 people between the two groups. So very small scale, exploratory, qualitative study, process oriented, meaning we're not really looking at outcomes. We're just looking to try to understand the experiences of the people going through it. And of the 11, from the two groups, four of them got better. This was a 10-week group. We did it for a couple hours a night for 10 weeks. And of the people that got better, we just kind of broke it down and said, okay, how did this group get, well, how did they experience the group, the people that got better versus these people that got, you know, like somewhat better? They gained some benefits but weren't completely better. And then there were two, there were five of them, and there were two people who said it really wasn't helpful at all. And so we broke that down and thought, what was the difference? So they were pretty clear, and I don't think they'd be surprising to you or people who follow this literature. The number one thing was the people who got better believed in this wholeheartedly from the start. They read the book. They came in saying, oh, my God, this is me. I can't wait to get started. I know this is going to be what cures me. They all had setbacks, like I talked about before, but the people who got better believed it was part of the process. The other group, other folks tended to doubt the setbacks. Yeah. There were no secondary gains, right? Secondary gains in chronic pain mean that there's some benefit to the person. And the two people who didn't get better talked about how there were some benefits to pain in terms of either what it did for them psychologically to protect them, or the care and concern that other people showed them when they were in pain and they didn't have any other options to get that. The amount of homework people put in. The folks who got better attended the groups religiously. They never missed a session. They did homework all the time on the outside. They were working at this constantly. The group that got sort of better was half in, half out, right? I believe this. I think it'd be helpful. But they also kept seeing chiropractors or consulting with surgeons or doing other things that weren't part of our program. And they didn't do homework outside. They talked about, I'm just, you know, I believe in this, but I'm just too busy. I don't have time. And yeah. As a result, they sort of got better in some ways, a little bit better, or psychologically they felt better, but they still had some pain. The group who didn't get better at all, the two people, they didn't do homework at all. They said, you know, it just didn't seem worth it. And, it, you know, I was disconnected from it. They just didn't do it. So those are some of the things we found that are, I think, pretty consistent with what Sarno might have said right from the start.
What were the homework components that the people in the homework group that were getting better? Tell us what those were.
Yeah, so we followed a program called Emotional Awareness and Expression Therapy, which was Mark Lumley and Howard Schubner did a fibromyalgia study, and I borrowed their manual, and we did something pretty similar. So we incorporated journaling, mindfulness-based meditation, and, you know, ISTDP like stuff that they would do in session with us. So the in-session groups were very emotion and anger focused. Oh, that was another one. The group that got better got really comfortable expressing and experiencing expressing emotions in therapy and the groups. And the people who didn't get better had a real hard time with it. And you could see them even in the session when people are, you know, starting to get angry, they'd get uncomfortable. They'd, oh my God, my back hurts. I got to get up. I got to leave. You know, or the one woman was trying to calm everyone down in the group. Why is everyone getting so upset? You know, shouldn't they just calm down? where the people that got better really were, they embraced their own strong emotions and they were really helpful to other people, encouraging them to, because they said, well, this made me better and it's going to make you better. So you should really engage in this. And wait, so out of the group, they did. Go ahead.
Was that done in group or was that done one-on-one?
We did both. We did small groups, and then for people who requested it, we did individual therapy too.
And did you notice any reluctance from the people in the group? Like people that were doing group? Because I could totally see how in a group setting, it may be hard to really go full board, 100%, say whatever you want to say, feel whatever you want to feel, you know, that kind of thing.
Yep. Some of the folks that were in the kind of moderate improvement group said that they were inhibited because of the group format and they weren't comfortable doing it. Some of them said my story is too powerful. Other people couldn't handle it. And the two people who actually didn't benefit actually said, I wished I could have done this individually because I think it would have been better for it. Even though I don't really believe in it, and I sort of do, I'm seeing other people get better in the group, and I have a feeling if I could do this individually, it'd be better. And in fact, one of the people did call me a year later and said, I wasn't ready for that before, and I'm ready for it now. And he's actually in therapy with me now and doing fantastic.
That's great. That's awesome. You know, this type of approach makes me, I've done a couple of episodes recently about the concept essentially of like angry rap music, and two of my very favorite artists / musicians of all time are Lady Gaga and Eminem. And if you look at their styles, and of course, like, you know, performance and singing and music and all that kind of stuff, that can completely be a character and a portrayal and all that kind of stuff, as opposed to, you know, what the actual person thinks, what the actual person believes. I'm pretty good at separate because I understand, like, you know, somebody acts something in a movie or a TV show. Like, Tom Hardy is not the Bane. He's not Bane, right? But he was the Bane character. But when I think about the kind of music that, like, Lady Gaga does, which is, you know, there's a lot of love and empowerment and all this kind of stuff. She's got really bad fibromyalgia.
Yes, I know that.
I mean, Nicole Sachs has been trying to get her on the line for like 2 years, and I really wish, because she's probably, if not number one, she's definitely in my top three of all time, and it would be awesome if, you know, that would be in her rearview mirror. But then I think about like Eminem, who, at least in the 90s, it was the most lewd, obscene, angry, ravaging, you know, lyrics and storytelling in his music ever. I don't ever hear about him ever talking about back pain or anything like that. So it's interesting being able to go to that, you know, super deep, dark place versus kind of staying on this positive, you know, positivity thing. I was working out yesterday and this pop song came on. I don't know who it was by or what it was called, but the lyrics were something like, think positive all the time and your life will change, I promise. And I remember just being like, I can't fucking live to this.
Oh,
like,
yeah. We TMS people just cringe at those, right? This idea. But here's the paradox to the whole thing, which I find just amazing. And I watch this with people all the time, is that people who go through this process, unlocking and getting in touch with these things, there afterwards there's nothing but kindness and forgiveness towards almost everyone. Yep. It's just we try to short circuit that. Everyone knows that it's harmful to hold on to anger. It's not good for you or the other person, but you can't short circuit it and just say, okay, I'm just going to not be that way anymore, mind over matter. It doesn't work that way. Yep. I've watched people in my office forgive people who have done horrible things to them, and a way that's meaningful and powerful and liberating to them after they go through and experience and express all the impulses towards that person. There is healing and kindness and forgiveness at the end of this road in a way that's incredibly powerful. You just can't short circuit it by trying to skip all the bad parts and just go to the forgiveness.
Right. And that was a distinction that I can't remember which of his books, but Sarno was insistent on. This isn't about positive thinking. This is a completely different thing, which is why the social media campaigns of hashtag positive vibes only has really rubbed me the wrong way in the last couple of years. Cause I'm like, I get it and I hear you. But something's missing.
It can be destructive to chronic pain people to think that they've just got the key to this is just to disregard their feelings and go straight to forgiveness. That's not authentic. That's not heartfelt. That's not experienced in the body. It's just more repression.
So one concept, pivoting gears here, because again, off air, this is what there was. There's actually off air with Dr. Hanscom a few weeks ago. I have 15 minutes of absolute gold that this is why I said to you as soon as we got on the line, let's save everything good we got until we're actually recording, because I've got 15 or 20 minutes of him talking about a think tank he's doing with doctors around the world on COVID prevention and treatment. And I'm like, I wish that I would have said, let's not talk about any really, really juicy stuff until we record. So that's why we did it. But before we started rolling, I was asking you, how has the Sarno theories evolved over time? And maybe what's a little bit different now? And you had made the comment that you don't really see book cures. That doesn't seem to be as prevalent as Sarno had made it out to be, which is true, right? Why don't you think that's a thing? And then I want to share with you why I think in 2020 it's not really much of a thing.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah, Sarno said he had a 90% cure rate with his folks, and a lot of them got better just through journaling and reading the book. And I haven't had that same kind of luck with my folks, that I feel like a lot of people need a coach, a therapist to help them push through and identify things, because we can put up a lot of defenses on our own. And, you know, a skilled therapist helps people break through a lot of those things and see things very, very differently that they couldn't possibly. I know from my own experience as a client, I'm still in therapy. I come out of every session just scratching my head going, oh my God, how did I not know that or see that about myself? I consider myself self-aware. I do all this meditation and I'm just clueless about some of these things. So I don't, you know, if you can get better by a book, that is amazing. I know there are a lot of people that do, but my experience is that people often need some help. I mean, the other thing that people like Howard are debating about Schubner is the oxygen deprivation side of it.
Yep.
And I know Howard Schubner says that that's probably not true anymore, that it's neural pathways in the brain, which I believe, but I also think there's still something to the oxygen deprivation. There are people that, you know, especially young kids that come in with these, you know, what they're calling, you know, like adolescent fibromyalgia type symptoms where they really aren't getting oxygen in different parts of their body. Parts are swelling up and turning purple and there's no oxygen there, and it's caused by the brain. So I'm not ready to throw away that part of the theory, but I understand that a lot of the chronic pain literature, especially back pain and shoulder knee pain, has moved towards neural pathways and away from oxygen deprivation.
God, I'm so glad that you brought up the debate between the two things. That's something else that I don't get asked about it as much, but I observe it a lot in the forums that I monitor and on the TMS Wiki and such, where people that have read the books and they fit into this middle group that you were talking about, where like they sort of believe it, but they continue doing all the stuff they were doing, and they say, but I need to know, is it neural pathways or is it oxygen deprivation? And to me, immediately, I'm like, fuck cares. It doesn't matter. The remedy is exactly the same. So like, why do you need to know whether it's one or the other? And I think that maybe part of it is like, well, if it is neural pathways and Sarno says that it's oxygen deprivation, then I can't believe anything else that's in it, which is, you know, it's a straw man argument, but it's just the way sometimes that things are. So one thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately. So 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, I finally just went up and deleted Facebook entirely from my phone, which doesn't seem like a big deal. But somebody like me who I literally, when I would look at the stats on my iPhone to tell me what's the amount of screen time on Facebook that I'm spending a day, and it would make me sick because it would be like, you know, 2.5 hours or 3 hours or whatever. And then I finally just deleted it. I'm like, oh, God, not only is my screen time significantly down, but I'm not observing all these things that are essentially keeping me in fight or flight all the time, triggering the shit out of me. But maybe the bigger part is that the distraction is not there. So somebody reads a book that has a theory that's in it, and they have to sit there with it and actually experience the things that Sarno was talking about, which he says unbelievable rage and anger and likely towards something that may have developed in childhood and people that are close to you and all this stuff, which is the same type of therapy that you were talking about, you know, 35 minutes ago. But if I have the opportunity to instead have all the accessibility of social media and the internet at my fingertips and all these other things that I can distract myself with, then I don't really have to spend any time thinking about what this book has told me. So I feel in a way that it's as simple as just, I have much more distraction opportunity at my fingertips.
Yeah, it's amazing how many ways we can distract ourselves now with technology in a way that's engrossing, right? That just takes us over. But at the same time, you know, so when I did this Sarno stuff years ago, there was no, you know, Facebook groups. I don't even think Facebook existed. And now all the groups and the podcasts and things, it actually can be very helpful too to people's recovery. Because I think social support, another thing that people in my group said who got better was that the social support of the groups was key to them getting through this, that they had the support of other people, that they could support them. And it just, as one person got better, it reinforced the fact that this is true, you know, and a true path to healing. And so I see social media as providing opportunities for people to get healthy in those ways, to connect with other people like them. I think podcasts like this, where people share their stories and other people listen and connect with it. I've made that a part of my program with my clients, that if you're not on social media, it might be a good idea to get on it just for this,
right?
Not to be distracted in the ways you're talking about, but to dive into a TMS group or the TMS forum, or, you know, one of these Nicole Sachs webpage or, you know, Facebook groups. People are chatting all the time, and it just immerses you in a way that you can get support and support each other.
Which, speaking of, it's not about social media, it's actually more about publication, but I had actually first heard about you, a podcast listener that reads, was it Psychology Today, Psychology Online?
Counseling Today, yeah.
Yeah, sent me, they said, hey, I don't know if you know it, but your name and your podcast is in this article, and they sent me a picture of it, and I was like, who's this Douglas Jeffrey? Well, I said Gefrida because that was that's how it looks. But but I was like, who is this guy? And then I had actually tweeted to Counseling Today, and I had said, hey, the archive for the July issue is not online yet. You know, is it going to be anytime soon? And they retweeted me back a couple days and said, we just published it. It's live online. And that's when you and I got connected. So thank you so much for the mention in the article that you wrote.
Well, thank you for what you do. I was real excited to find your podcast. Yours was one of the, I don't know if it was the first one, but it was the first one I found. And it was really transformative to me too, to hear all these people that I've been reading about and then the recovery stories. It's part of the program that I tell people, you got to listen to this podcast too, or find another one if you find one you like better. But you've got to be immersed in this all the time. Because the way the brain works is it's clever, it's sneaky, it's constantly trying to deceive you because it thinks it's protecting you. And podcasts and things like this constantly reinforce this healing process. So thanks for what you do too.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And not to be that guy, but I was the first, at least of the TMS. I mean, there's lots of quote unquote self-help podcasts that are out there, but it was me, and then it was Caitlin Michaels, and then it was Nicole Sachs, and I think that might be, well, the Curable started doing one, and then Alan Gordon did more, one that was specific for him, and so it's definitely better. Dr. Hanscom, my guess, he's had an online radio show for a long time, but to me, that's a little bit more in the spine surgery-esque realm. Like, it doesn't specifically say mind-body connection stuff, and that's all that we're going to be talking about. So it's been 3 years and 135. By the time people hear this, 138 episodes probably. And some of the stories are wild, from the back pain to anxiety to depression to vestibular disorders was not long ago. And there's a couple coming up. That woman that lives in France, I think, had, you know, multiple surgeries to alleviate stomach problems, and none of it worked. And then she did journaling. She journaled for 28 straight days on Nicole Sachs's program and was better at the end of 28 days after, you know, two decades and like a dozen surgeries. So it's
amazing.
The stories are wild. Getting to more present day, kind of as we wrap, you know, one thing that I would be curious to get your take on, because Dr. Hanscom and I did talk a little bit about COVID stuff, and there's a lot of things at play here. There is the heightened sense of fear, and I can hear it in everybody in my circles as well as out. There's the media that is, you know, arguably perpetuating a good portion of that fear. There's also the very real chance that somebody in your circle could catch it. But there's so many of these things to be concerned with. And I guess, where does therapy, because there's probably a lot of people listening to this that have recovered from mind-body syndrome in some way, shape, or form, and now comes this real-world pandemic. And then very impressionable people may start feeling symptoms. And it probably isn't COVID, right? Like statistics would say, if you start having a fever, you start coughing or whatever, the odds you have COVID are very minimal, despite what it seems like on the news. Can this kind of stuff either help you build a better immune system, or is there anything in this realm that people can apply to COVID and the fears around catching it or getting very sick from it? In, I guess, in the opinion that you could have gathered in the last 5 months since it's been here.
Yeah, the only thing, so I'm not an expert on this, and I think there's so much we don't know right now. I do know for years I've been, like, when someone calls me, one of my clients, and calls me and says they had the flu and they don't want to come in because they don't want to get me sick, I never worry about getting the flu from them. And I'll tell them that, because it manifests, mind-body symptoms can often manifest as flu-like symptoms, even if people spike a fever. I've never caught it from one of them, and sometimes right in therapy, they'll come in really sick and walk away feeling better. But COVID's a different, it's a totally different thing. And so I'm not, you know, I'm taking it very, very seriously. At the same time, I do know that, I mean, there has been research ever since the 50s, actually some of it that came out from the University of Rochester, where I am, back in the 50s, that inexplicably linked without doubt the immune system to the brain. Some pretty powerful research that shows that people under different types of stress are much more susceptible to disease than people who aren't. And a guy named Robert Ader, if anyone's interested, did an incredible study back in the 50s that before anyone had any idea that there could be a mind-body connection to the autoimmune system, did a study with rats. He was giving them saccharin-flavored drink that had an immune suppressant in it that made them sick, just to see if they would learn to avoid it. And they did. They stopped drinking it because they figured out it was making them sick. But then he did something else. He started force feeding them the same stuff, only it didn't have the immune suppressant drug in it. Mm-hmm. And the most amazing thing happened. The rats got sick and many of them died. Yep. Even though they weren't getting the immune suppressant anymore. That was powerful. People couldn't ignore that. That was the most powerful thing that had ever, and as much as it, no one agreed with it and they didn't want to see it, they couldn't turn away from it because it was powerful. And then they did many other studies that showed that the immune system is very closely linked to the brain and emotions. And so there has to be something related to this. But I, you know, there's lots of research to be done to figure out how we can apply this in the current day. And I'm, you know, still sticking to back pain and, you know, all the things that I know it works for now.
This is going to be the last thing to talk about. It's totally unrelated. But you just said something that made me think of it, and maybe your answer will be no, and that will be that. But you used the term flu-like symptoms, and whenever I hear flu-like symptoms, I always think of Michael Jordan. Did you watch the Last Dance documentary series at all?
Oh, yeah, I loved it.
So I was going to bring this up with Dr. Hanscom, and then I totally spaced it. But I'm curious, in watching that, particularly with Scottie Pippen, he had some issues of injury. So there was the ankle thing, which occurred right around when he was looking for that for a new contract, and it wasn't happening. And then there was the bigger one to me was the excessive back spasms at the end of the 1998 playoffs. I mean, when you watch things like this, do you find yourself armchair quarterbacking with what it is that you do for a living, or is it just kind of like, he's an athlete and things happen?
Yeah, no, I see everything from a mind body perspective. So, I know people can actually hurt their backs, but that's very, very rare that a back pain is caused by an injury that needs a physical, you know, intervention. So yeah, my view is pretty biased. Also, even, you know, food poisoning, I get lots of my folks who come in saying they had food poisoning, but nobody else gets sick. You know, everybody else ate the same meal. It's a mind body thing at that point. It's not food poisoning. They get treated. They get full on sick, dehydrated, have to go to the emergency room. But how is it that a whole bunch of other people ate the same food and they didn't get sick? It's happened so many to my mind body folks, to so many of them that I, you know, I like all of this stuff. there's, you know, it's real. Food poisoning obviously is a real thing that can kill people, but a lot of mind body people show symptoms like that when they weren't, didn't experience food poisoning. And so what we start to unpack is, what were you talking about at dinner? Who were you with? What was going on? And lo and behold, we always get to something that gets triggered. Someone said something and it made them think about something else that was incredibly painful, and they're trying to avoid something that they didn't realize. And so, yeah, I view everything that way. And one of the things that's exciting to me as a therapist is people come in with a setback, right? So they tend to, getting better to me, what I explain to my folks is, it's like a healthy stock market curve, right? You don't want to see dramatic improvement because it's usually followed by dramatic collapse. Mm-hmm. You want something that looks like a healthy stock market with, you know, goes up in a curve that might drop a little bit. And one of the things we love is the drops, right? I was all better, and then I had this flare up. All right, let's talk about what was going on. And lo and behold, we roll up our sleeves and unpack the whole thing, and we figure out they got triggered by something, and it was something they didn't even realize. And so, yeah, that I see the whole world that way. I'm not, you know, if I get in a car accident, my spine gets crushed, I'm going for back surgery. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But if I bend over and stand up and my back throws out, backs are designed to do that. I'm going to a therapist.
Yep. God, the food poisoning thing is really making me think. And I've had thoughts about this before, but you know, most people in my life that I know either never get food poisoning, and they may get it once in their lifetime. And I have probably had it one or two times a year, every year for the last 5 or 6 years, unfortunately. And you know, right when it happens and your head's in the toilet bowl, you're just thinking, man, my luck just really sucks. But I mean, thinking further about it, it's like, I don't think my luck's that bad. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like there's got to be something else. And it sucks because, like, I drive by my favorite sushi place, can't eat there anymore because that was, you know, that was where this thing probably happened. I don't know. It's the gamut and the continuum of it just continues to impress me. And,
oh, I used to get it. I used to get it all the time, too. I would have, like, you know, sudden violent illness that couldn't be explained any other way. I must have had food poisoning. And, but again, nobody else got sick. Why just me?
Right.
You know, there's a whole restaurant full of people probably eating the same thing that I ate, yet there's no outbreak of it.
Right.
And, you know, it's so powerful because that's what it's designed to do. It's designed to make you distracted from anything that could have been triggered there. The more violent the symptoms, the more powerful the emotion underneath it usually. And so, again, you go in, meet with someone like me, and we're going to unpack it and say, what was going on that night? What got triggered? And usually people say, oh, nothing. All I did was, you know, I talked to my daughter and I, you know, went to this and that. And I'll say, well, sometimes we hit some dead ends, but I'll say, well, what'd you talk to your daughter about? Well, nothing. Just the fact that, you know, she's moving and taking the kids with her and going to, you know, moving across the country. And I say, oh, okay. Well, how was that for you? Well, it's okay. I'm supportive of that. But then we start unpacking it. And we realize that's incredibly disturbing to the person. They just didn't think they were allowed to feel it.
Yep.
You know, those kinds of things. And then all lo and behold, we go, oh my God. And they walk out going, like I walk out when I'm a client going, oh my God, how did I not know I had all that going on inside of me?
Dr. Jafrida, this has been awesome. If people really dig the stuff that you're talking about, where can they find you? Either things that you've written, or if they wanted to get in contact with you or your methodologies, or kind of tell us where we can get more about you.
Yeah, so I have a website, douglasjafrida.com. People can contact me through there if they'd like to chat. The counseling licenses are per state. So now that we're doing teletherapy, you know, really it could be unlimited, but the laws haven't caught up with it yet. Yeah. There have, however, been some states that have loosened their regulations for healthcare and have allowed licensed mental health counselors like me to counsel people in different states. So it's up to people to check their own regulations to see what their state's allowing and what isn't. But for the most part, when things go back to normal, it's supposed to be, you know, I can see people via teletherapy, but just people in New York State. But you know, I'm always happy to consult with people who just have questions or want to know more about my experience, because you know, it's kind of like a mission, like you probably, for doing this. When you get saved by this, Sarno saved my life. I think I'd be dead by now if I didn't find this. And so it's a calling to be able to help other people get through it in the same way that I was helped. And so I'm happy to talk to other people who just have questions or send them an email.
Thanks so much again for your time. This was awesome.
Thank you. It was a real treat for me too, having listened all these years. So thanks for you for doing this.
Okay, so maybe my rendition wasn't quite as good as the original, but nevertheless, here we are. Welcome to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. My name is Eddie.